The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay,
can you
all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. So today we're going to talk about a specter. Not the specter of communism that once haunted the ruling classes of the world, and us willing, will do so again, but the specter that's been haunting the American left for over a century. The specter of the Democratic Party. So, I know a talk about the Democratic Party might seem basic. We all understand that the Democratic Party has done a million awful things, and that it'd be so much better if we had a party of our own. But how we understand the Democratic Party and the role it plays has massive impacts on how we organize and struggle today. And this year is 2018. We all know what that means. It's midterm election year, a chance for the Democrats to take the House and Senate from the deranged monsters. There are a lot of people on the left today that see Bernie Sanders' astonishing run against Clinton, some Democrats jumping on board with things like Medicare for All and some version of a federal jobs guarantee, all as a sign that the left's path to winning power and reforms must be with and through the Democratic Party. They see the party itself as a kind of neutral trough, which currently happens to be filled with the foul excrement of neoliberalism, but could instead be filled with the sweet red wine of socialism. The Democratic Party has passed progressive legislation in the past, after all, and they're ostensibly the party of unions, welfare, social tolerance, and the hashtag resistance. On the other side of the coin, we often hear that socialists must always oppose the Democratic Party on principle, a principled opposition to the Democrats. From my experience, I don't believe this is a compelling argument to lead with. A better argument we hear is that we must oppose the Democratic Party because it is in its very nature a capitalist party, which is certainly true. But what does that actually mean in practice? So for my half of this talk, I'm going to dig into the modern history of the Democratic Party, all the way from the creation of the New Deal and the forging of the relationship between the labor movement and the Democratic Party, to the attempts to realign the party around a liberal labor coalition in the 60s and 70s, to the end of the quote-unquote New Deal era with the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Through this history, I primarily hope to A, put some meat on the bones of what it really means for the Democratic Party to be a capitalist party, and what that in turn means for ongoing projects to transform that party into a real party of the people, and B, show that significant reforms really, really, really have never been won through movements supporting the Democrats. They have always been won through building and wielding independent power. And after that, Amy will take over, bringing us home to now, analyzing the struggles we've seen since Trump's election, and providing important lessons for how we need to organize and fight back today. So, without further ado, let's talk about the New Deal. That wonderful time that many progressive Democrats look back on as the undisputed high mark of the party of FDR, supporting unionization, a massive public works program, Social Security, and so on. And these reforms and programs were, without question, immensely beneficial for many working people. But FDR did not run for president on a platform of workers' rights and building a welfare state. He actually ran on a platform of balanced budgets, saying he would cut federal spending by 25%. Well, that doesn't sound very progressive at all. So how the heck did the New Deal happen? To answer that, we need to look outside the electoral context, which is generally everybody's focus, and towards the massive economic crisis that was unfolding and the labor movement that was rapidly growing in size and militancy. The Great Depression began in October 1929. Within 1 year, the stock market plunged by 90%. Thousands of banks across the country collapsed. Industrial production in America was cut in half. Three quarters of the US population was living in poverty, and one third were unemployed. And some real hashtag resistance emerged. The first signs came from the unemployed, demanding food and basic necessities. People mobbed trucks, there was organized looting, people marched on shopkeepers. There were massive protests against evictions. In 1932, the unemployed workers' councils in New York City, led by communists, won enormous victories, getting over 77,000 evicted families back into their homes. Major municipalities began to go bankrupt amid this growing unrest. The mayor of this here city of Chicago told Congress that, and I quote, "If the federal government doesn't send $150 million for relief immediately, they should be prepared to send troops." And if that wasn't destabilizing enough, we saw a rapidly growing and defiant labor movement. They were striking, they were radicalizing, and they were winning. In 1934 especially, there was a series of huge and victorious strikes led primarily by revolutionary socialists. In Toledo, Ohio, 10,000 workers went on strike, facing down not just their bosses, but 900 National Guardsmen ordered in to break the strike. In this, we saw a beautiful glimpse of what real solidarity looks like when the Lucas County Unemployed League joined together with the workers, knowing that their interests were not served by taking the strikers' jobs, but by arming themselves with bricks and stones and helping the union win. 85 local unions eventually called for a general strike in support, and the company finally surrendered, which led to widespread unionization in Toledo and laid the groundwork for what would later become the United Auto Workers. There was also the 83-day West Coast waterfront strike, including a 5-day general strike in San Francisco that shut the entire city down. This victory led to the mass unionization of all West Coast ports. And in that same year, a general strike shook Minneapolis, where strikers, led by Trotskyists, again faced down the bosses and the police and emerged victorious. These were massive and violent confrontations with capital. They were insurrections. They showed the power of masses of organized workers. Industrial unionism was growing, the Communist Party and other left-wing groups were growing, tenants organizing, farmers getting out their pitchforks, shit was getting real. The governor of Mississippi, Theodore Bilbo, told an interviewer, "Folks are getting restless. Communism is gaining a foothold. Right here in Mississippi, some people are about ready to lead a mob. In fact, I'm getting a little pink myself." American capitalism was in crisis. At this point, a sector of capital broke away from the standard business consensus and backed the Democratic Party in the building of the New Deal. These were mostly capital-intensive, multinational industries that now believed that state intervention in the economy was necessary to save capitalism. They knew that they would benefit from demand stimulation from welfare programs, and they were less sensitive to increased labor prices and believed that concessions to labor and incorporating it into the political system would close out its more radical nature and smooth out business operations. They were terrified that without government intervention, there would be no recovery, and even worse, there could be revolution. This was the context in which the New Deal programs were enacted. FDR and his capital backers' hands were forced by a collapsing economy and the highest point of class struggle in U.S. history, which threatened to overthrow the entire system. FDR himself said that, and I quote, "It was this administration which saved the system of private profit and free enterprise after it had been dragged to the brink of ruin." And in fact, while the Democrats were signing New Deal legislation with one hand, they were using the other to call in the troops against striking workers. In 1935 alone, 20 state militias, the majority under Democratic New Deal governors, fought against strikers in 73 different disputes. There were frequent backroom betrayals, Democrats siding with the bosses and on many occasions refusing to apply the very laws meant to protect workers that they had just passed. Even with these betrayals, FDR signing the New Deal managed to do precisely what he hoped it would do. It improved the economy and reined in the workers' movement, bringing it into the fold of the Democratic Party machine. Instead of the labor leadership seeing their victories and growing membership as a means to build their own strength, they saw it as a way of giving them leverage within these formal halls of power. Union leaders then found themselves, to maintain their credibility within the establishment, working in direct opposition to the rank and file of their unions, who were not so won over to collaboration with the Democratic Party. Going into the 1936 election, it was not actually clear that labor was going to endorse FDR. At both the AFL and CIO's conventions, resolutions in support of building a labor party had high levels of support. The United Auto Workers actually voted down a resolution supporting FDR's re-election campaign and voted in favor of building an independent farmer labor party. The CIO immediately responded by threatening to cut their funding unless they rescinded that vote. The UAW eventually capitulated and endorsed FDR. Sidney Hillman, the leader of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, said, "I say to you that the defeat of Roosevelt and the introduction of a real fascist administration is going to make the work of building a labor movement impossible." A statement strikingly similar to things we still hear today. Amidst all this, industrial militancy declined, and with it, momentum for progressive legislation came to a halt, and labor's newly won reforms began to erode. In 1941, the AFL and CIO agreed to a no-strike pledge until World War II was over. They accepted that being a part of this political establishment required them to demonstrate their patriotic credentials. In 1943, the Smith-Connolly Act passed Congress. This act allowed the government to seize and operate industries threatened by strikes that would interfere with war production. Notably, this act was vetoed by FDR, showing his supposed credibility with labor. However, Congress had enough votes to override his veto, including a bunch of Democrats. FDR then proceeded to use the act repeatedly against the labor movement. So much for not believing in it. Operation Dixie, the CIO's effort to unionize the South, failed largely because of fear that direct confrontation with Southern Democrats would destroy the Labor Democratic coalition. And perhaps most damaging of all, the majority of congressional Democrats helped pass the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, which banned solidarity and wildcat strikes, allowed states to pass right-to-work laws, allowed the president to intervene in strikes that create national emergencies, and most infamously, it specifically banned communists and radicals from holding union office. All union officers were required to sign pledges forswearing membership in the Communist Party or their union would be decertified. After enactment, the CIO began purging itself of communists and radicals, expelling 12 entire unions that refused to go along with the anti-communist pledges. These radicals were frequently the most militant and committed members to the struggle, and the union movement found itself drained of its energy and greater sense of mission. The capture of the labor movement with the New Deal did not turn the Democratic Party into a social democratic or a labor party. The labor movement's Faustian bargain with the Democrats, hoping to secure and enhance their newfound positions of power, led to their complete undermining. But perhaps the possibility of really capturing the Democratic Party and making it serve the people wasn't dead yet. Going into the 1960s, many of the best organizers and activists on the US left saw what they believed was the golden opportunity to finally achieve this. This was because the Democratic Party, born out of the New Deal, contained a significant fissure. It was a coalition between Southern segregationist whites, aka the Dixiecrats, and the Northern urban political machines with labor as a supportive role, and of course, behind the scenes, the more liberal, multinational wing of capital. This fissure between the Northern liberals and Dixiecrats had been relatively benign for decades. Compromises could generally be made to get a few things that the Northern Democrats wanted while allowing the Dixiecrats to continue Jim Crow segregation. The real watershed moment came when the struggles of the civil rights movement emerged and exposed in no uncertain terms the brutality of much of American society, totally upending the calculus of the more liberal wing of the party. The same multinational sectors of capital that backed the New Deal strongly supported LBJ and promoted the Great Society programs. They again felt forced to act in order to put the brakes on a movement that was becoming increasingly militant, influencing much of the Democratic Party's base, and creating a lot of embarrassing headlines that threatened the expansion of US capital's sphere of influence throughout the decolonizing world. Jim Crow was not a good look for a country that claimed freedom and democracy in order to justify its imperialist adventures and plundering. And naturally, these firms dominated LBJ's cabinet and were able to write the bills and make sure things like the new welfare programs were paid via payroll taxes, not profits. LBJ signing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act set the stage for the disintegration of the North-South coalition. And unions, segments of the civil rights movement, and many prominent activists, including Bayard Rustin and Michael Harrington, set out to build a liberal labor coalition within the Democratic Party to take advantage of this realignment and take control of the party. This coalition itself was rife with its own fissures from the very beginning that would prove to be debilitating, particularly over the Vietnam War, which was strongly supported by the staunchly anti-communist president of the AFL-CIO, George Meany, also appropriately named. Additionally, much of this coalition was beholden to the most powerful Democrat, LBJ, who continued to escalate the war. And as is so often the case, many of these realignment activists got drawn deeper into machine politics and moved further away from movement work, their outward politics changed, and they essentially became part of the establishment. And this isn't for any sort of lack of moral purity, this is simply the reality of entering into a coalition where your political adversaries have far more leverage in it than you do. Michael Harrington, however, and his wing of the Realignment Project pressed forward on trying to remake the party. And in the 70s, a series of reforms were enacted that opened the party up, particularly regarding the presidential nominating process. But that victory didn't come without significant struggle in the streets either. In 1968, the Democratic Party nominated for president Hubert Humphrey, who had run in literally no primaries whatsoever, and was officially selected at a convention made infamous for mass protests and the incredible violent repression against them by the Chicago Police Department. Notably, it was also where the Youth International Party, the Yippies, held their own convention to nominate Pegasus, a literal 145-pound pig, for president. When they later went to trial on accusations of disorderly conduct, disturbing the peace, and bringing a pig to Chicago, their defense counsel shot back, accusing the Democratic Party of doing the exact same thing. Anyway, these reforms contributed to the 1972 nomination of the liberal anti-war senator George McGovern, who later went on to lose every state to Nixon except Massachusetts. The common narrative from this is that the party became too democratic and was pulled so far to the left that they ruined their chances with the moderate American electorate. But this analysis doesn't take into account important dynamics that were at play during that election, and the fact that winning the nomination and controlling the Democratic Party are two very different things. The AFL-CIO leadership refused to endorse McGovern because of his anti-war position and out of anger over his role in the union bureaucracy's own loss of backroom dealing from the recent party reforms, which meant a big loss of organizing resources for McGovern. Towards the end of his first term, Nixon successfully maneuvered to win the support of the multinational firms and global exporters that typically back the Democrats, essentially having all of capital behind him. And lastly, the economy was on upswing going into the election. Nixon greatly expanded the U.S. money supply and rapidly grew the economy, which isn't a sustainable long-term policy, but for the time being, made the economy look strong. Given all this and much more that I can go into here, McGovern's massive loss to Nixon is actually of little surprise. Of course, the Republican Party would soon be in the throes of the Watergate crisis, and Jimmy Carter wins the next presidential election, with Democrats having supermajorities in both the House and Senate. Harrington and the realigners had fully endorsed Carter. Harrington stated that if Carter wins, he will owe his victory in considerable measure to the working class politically organized as a class. And Carter's platform was pretty good. Federal Consumer Protection Agency, pro-union labor law reform, and a federal full employment bill. Realigners had a lot to be excited about, but little did they know that the political terrain was about to swiftly turn against them. The 1970s saw the end of the post-war economic boom and a series of economic crises. Profits rapidly declined, unemployment increased, global stock markets crashed, the 1973 oil crisis tripled the price of oil overnight, sending shockwaves through the economy, and the economy entered stagflation. In response to this, capital launches an all-out assault on labor. Firms began challenging nearly every unionization election, firing pro-union workers, and aggressively going after wages and benefits. Unlike the 30s, besides a brief labor rebellion in the early 70s that quickly receded as unemployment grew, there was no militant labor movement to fight back. And without that, even the capital-intensive backers of the Democratic Party that could more easily absorb higher labor costs saw no reason to compromise. And to make matters worse, the lack of radical labor organization at the time was met with an increasingly organized capitalist class. The Business Roundtable was formed, the Trilateral Commission was formed, the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce rapidly grew in size and influence. This change of class forces ripped apart Carter's agenda. The Consumer Protection Agency and Common Sense Picketing, which had previously passed Congress, only to be vetoed by Ford, failed to pass again with the majority of new Democrats elected in 1977 opposing it. Labor law reform went down, the Full Employment Act passed, but by the time that happened, it went from an actual full employment bill to a completely toothless bill stating that the president will simply report progress towards full employment. Very helpful. Popular anger over the rapid increases in the price of oil led Carter to increase taxes on the oil industry, which then led to Big Oil, a powerful wing of capital that had been a backer of the Democratic Party since the New Deal, to back the Republicans. This loss emboldened Carter's remaining capital backers to pressure the administration for even more concessions. The Carter administration enacted sharp cuts in corporate taxes, cuts to the federal budget, welfare programs, deregulation of airlines, trucking, and banking, a move to the right on foreign policy, and the appointment of Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve, who later implemented the Volcker shock, which drove up interest rates to intentionally force a deeper recession, jack up unemployment, and tear apart much of what remained of union strongholds in order to restore profitability. And even after all this, Harrington and his fellow realigners supported Carter in his 1980 re-election bid, which he lost to Reagan. So this is the basis of the massive rightward turn in American politics that brought us to the political period we are in today. Neoliberalism was introduced with Carter with Democratic majorities in both houses, and this isn't because the electorate turned to the right or there was a particularly bad bunch of people elected. It was because the economy and the balance of class forces changed with no independent left to fight back. So to wrap this all up, at the end of the day, the Democratic Party has always had this divide between its capital backers and its mass base of support, which has made the belief that it can be captured by the base that elects it a kind of common sense for activists for over a century. There have been so many attempts to do this. The populists in the 1890s, labor in the 30s, civil rights movement and its allies in the 60s and 70s, Rainbow Coalition in the 80s, and they've all failed. The Democratic Party has changed before, but it always adheres remarkably well to the needs of whichever wings of capital are backing it, from laissez-faire liberalism to state intervention and welfare to neoliberalism. The Democratic Party is not a mass membership party. Its only dues-paying members are the capitalists. We have seen time and time again that when movements orient on the Democratic Party, they lose their ability to effectively fight them while diminishing their ability to build their own forces. And these are really interesting and exciting times today when it comes to figuring out how best to carry forward the politics of the centrality of independent political organizing. There are critically important debates emerging right now, especially after the incredible victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, about how socialists with these politics should be engaging with the growing movements that are running open socialists on the Democratic Party ballot line. What I think is truly clear, though, is that no matter what happens, the only pro-worker legislation that will ever be signed in Congress are the ones that will be won in the workplaces and on the streets. We need to figure out how to best build a new generation of militant social movements and labor unions that can directly confront capital, and to do so, we will have to break away from the Democratic Party. And if we can succeed in that, we will have nothing to lose but our chains.
So I'm going to fast forward just a little bit up to Trump's election. So the response to Trump's election was immediate. Less than a day after the results were announced, people across the country poured into the streets, expressing grief and rage that someone as outwardly and despicably sexist, racist, ableist, and xenophobic as Trump had won the presidency. They also turned out to express ongoing frustration with a broken political system where yet again the loser of the popular vote was taking control of the White House. But of course it didn't stop there. Over the next year and a half, as the Trump administration made good on its promises to implement the reactionary agenda he laid out during his campaign, ordinary people responded again and again. Following the protests after election night, there was a buoying of support for the ongoing struggle at Standing Rock. The next big moment came at Trump's inauguration with the J20 protests. The day after that were the women's marches. Then there were the airport protests and bodega strikes in response to Trump's Muslim travel ban. There was the People's Climate March. There were mass disruptions at town hall meetings in response to the Republican Party's attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Mass action and arrests of disabled activists in Washington, D.C., protesting cuts to Medicaid and the Republican budget plan. Counter demonstrations against far-right mobilizations in Portland, Oregon, Charlottesville, Boston, Berkeley, rallies across the country in solidarity with Dreamers against Trump's attack on DACA, resistance against the Republican tax bill, and also some smaller protests around net neutrality and Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy to occupy Jerusalem at this time. The women's marches came back again in 2018, smaller than in 2017, but still massive. And though it didn't have mass expression in the streets, the Me Too movement brought down powerful men in entertainment, business, sports, and politics. There are student walkouts and the March for Our Lives following the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Of course, the teacher strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky, North Carolina, Puerto Rico. Protests against racism and police brutality have continued, most recently in response to the murder of 17-year-old Antoine Rose in Pittsburgh. And just last weekend, the Families Belong Together protests in hundreds of cities across the country, protesting Trump's cruel border policies and even raising the demand for the abolition of ICE. So taken all together, the scale of these protests have been massive. The 2017 women's marches alone were the largest day of protests in American history. More than 1 in 100 Americans participated in a women's march in 2017. It's a protest so big you can kind of use it for small talk, just like at a party, like, oh, hey, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do? Which women's march did you go to? Like, I've done that before, it works. According to the Washington Post, 1 in 5 Americans have protested in the streets or participated in a political rally since the beginning of 2016. Of those, 19% said that they have never before joined a march or political gathering. While this statistic does reflect turnout for political rallies of all kind, on the right and the left, the vast majority of people have turned out to oppose Trump and his administration's policies. The array of issues that people have mobilized around has been incredibly broad, making the protests significant in scope as well as size. And these issues aren't necessarily siloed off in people's minds. It's not uncommon at these protests to see signs and hear speeches that draw out connections between these issues. And anti-Trump sentiment isn't the only connecting thread. For a not insignificant layer of people, there's a call to confront not only Trump, but deeper systems of oppression and exploitation. There's a growing interest in socialist politics that connects these struggles to a larger fight against capitalism. Another striking feature of resistance under Trump is that the driving force calling for protests has come more so from ordinary people than from the larger, more established advocacy groups, unions, and a certain political party. Many protests have been organized over social media by individuals who felt that they just couldn't sit by without doing something. And absent a political lead from the larger organizations, ordinary people have had to set their own. And one of my comrades, Akuna, made a comment at a meeting a few months ago that's really stuck with me. I just want to paraphrase what she said. She said, you can imagine someone the night before a protest sitting with their blank poster board and supplies, thinking to themselves, what should my sign say? What do I think needs to be said? These protests have led to millions of individuals thinking through their own personal political interventions. I think when we raise the chant, this is what democracy looks like, that's exactly what we mean. Yet as powerful as these mass demonstrations have been, there has been a significant gap between the size of mobilization and their level of organization. The protests have largely been episodic, followed by further attacks from the right. It's been an up and down roller coaster, at times leaving people with a dizzying sense of disillusionment. Every one of these protests has faced the question of how to translate the demands that are kind of raised within the crowd into real lasting change. There's a general understanding, I think, that protest alone is not enough, and that it's going to take a much higher level of organization to get to a point where we can defeat Trump and start to win gains for our side. And for the vast majority of people participating in these protests, the political organization that appears to have the strongest chance of doing this is the Democratic Party. But what kind of resistance has the Democratic Party mounted? While ordinary people correctly read Trump's ascendancy to power as something that needed to be challenged immediately, key leaders of the Democratic Party advised a different course of action. In her concession speech, Hillary Clinton instructed her supporters, "We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power, and we don't just respect that, we cherish it." In Barack Obama's first press conference following the 2016 election, he remarked, "The people have spoken. Donald Trump will be the next president. And those who didn't vote for him have to recognize that that's how democracy works. That's how this system operates." Many Democrats in the Senate demonstrated in practice exactly how this system operates by lending their support to Trump's cabinet nominations. Rick Perry, Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley, Elaine Chao, Rex Tillerson, and James Mattis all received confirmation votes from Democratic senators. And while some in the party have taken a more outward anti-Trump posture, the party as a whole has tailed behind the anti-Trump protests, even at times attempting to curtail them with calls for civility, among other things. While the resistance led by ordinary people has creatively, courageously, and consistently pushed back against Trump's reactionary agenda, the resistance as led by the Democratic Party has focused on two things, Mueller and the midterms. So I'm not here from the New York Times, so I'm not gonna go and comment at length on the absolutely riveting twists and turns of the Mueller investigation. But I will say, as it relates to the resistance, the Democrats have relied on the Mueller investigation as a way to deflect demands for Trump's impeachment, which has been raised repeatedly since his election. Perhaps the closest they came to moving on impeachment was right after Trump extended his sympathies to the white supremacists who murdered Heather Heyer at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Representative Al Green unveiled articles of impeachment on the House floor, but then intentionally missed the window to formally introduce the measure, delaying it indefinitely, so as not to pressure others in the party to take a position that might be seen as obstructionist. I mean, God forbid the Democrats obstruct Trump in a situation with millions of people marching in the streets and with polling showing near Nixon-level support for impeachment. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has discouraged Democrats from campaigning on impeachment in the midterm elections, saying impeachment is not a policy agenda and that people should let the Mueller investigation take its course. Because after all, we don't just respect the Mueller investigation, we cherish it. For most of the political problems that have drawn people into the streets, the solution from the Democratic Party has been to remember in November. Their argument being, with the Republican Party in control of the presidency, as well as the House, Senate, and with majorities in the state legislatures as well, the most pragmatic way for social movements to push their agenda is to flip the House and win back as many seats as possible in the Senate. This forthcoming blue wave will be the political poultice that will finally allow the Democrats to stand up to Trump's agenda. The call to funnel time, energy, and resources from the protest movements into the midterms has not gone unanswered. The theme for the first anniversary of the historic women's marches was hashtag power to the polls, which the Women's March website said was a call for demonstrators to, quote, I quote, harness our collective energy to elect candidates that reflect the values we marched for on January 21st, 2017. After building the second largest mobilization since Trump's election, many organizers with the March for Our Lives have shifted their focus to voter registration drives with the goal of voting out politicians with ties to the NRA, in most cases replacing them with Democrats. Many people are looking to the midterms as an opportunity not just to win back any old Democrat majority, but to bring in fresh new leadership. In a challenge to Trump's overt misogyny, there's been a spike in the number of women running for office, more than twice as many as there were in 2016. There have been some inspiring campaigns mounted by candidates distinguishing themselves as part of the progressive wing in the party, like Cynthia Nixon's challenge to Andrew Cuomo in the New York gubernatorial race. And even more encouragingly, we've seen candidates running as open socialists, with dozens of DSA members running for office across the country at nearly every level, including, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the 28-year-old Puerto Rican woman from the Bronx, running on an unapologetically democratic socialist platform, who just won a stunning primary upset over incumbent Joe Crowley, the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House. Now, it's a good thing. It's people responding to someone actually putting forward some politics of hope. And there's a lot more that I can say about her victory than I have time to get into, and I hope we can bring it up in this discussion. But one thing that stood out to me in that story was that she won despite being outspent 10-1 by Crowley's campaign. And many other candidates running on anti-Trump social movement-inspired platforms have found their greatest challenger in the primary has been the Democratic Party itself. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the campaign arm of the party, discourages working class people in particular from running for office with something called the Rolodex test, in which first-time candidates are asked to pull out their cell phones, go through their contact list, and show they can raise $250,000 or more from their personal contacts alone. If they can't do it, party support goes elsewhere. So I'd like everyone to pull out your phone and go through your contact list. And I thought this was a meeting of serious people. And it doesn't all happen behind closed doors. The DCCC is at times very public with its stance towards progressive candidates. Take, for example, Laura Moser, running for Congress in Texas's 7th congressional district. She campaigned on women's reproductive rights, single-payer health care, sane gun control, and sustainable energy. The DCCC paid to run ads during the primary, labeling her a Washington insider and a carpetbagger with an outright disgust for life in Texas. The aim is to damage her campaign, but this kind of thing also serves to reinforce negative stereotypes about the working class, because everyone knows that decent healthcare in a planet that's not on fire is just for the coastal elites. While they claim to be neutral in primary races, the DCCC's Red to Blue strategy, in which they've identified districts with vulnerable Republican incumbents that they think they have the chance to unseat, has the campaign arm of the party aggressively pushing out progressive left-leaning candidates in order to ensure electable Democrats wind up on the ballot in November. These types of maneuvers, favoring the already wealthy, running smear campaigns, and undemocratically pressuring progressive candidates to drop out of the race before voters can even express a preference, should come as no surprise to anyone who followed the Democratic primary for the 2016 presidential election, in which the party establishment clearly favored Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. In most cases, that means the party is shaping a national slate of candidates that leaves voters very limited opportunities to actually elect representatives who, like the Women's March organizers said, reflect the values we marched for on January 21st, 2017. Put simply, the party strategies for the protest movement is this: the only way for you to advance your agenda is for Democrats to win back Congress. And the only way for Democrats to win back Congress is for you to vote for candidates who don't support your agenda. Now, I think Dave summed this up well, but it's important to be clear on why the Democratic Party has not taken a stronger stand. It's not because when Republicans go low, they go high, nor is it due to a lack of popular support for the demands raised by the protests and by some of these progressive candidates. A lot of these demands are really popular. And it's not because they're actually powerless to oppose Trump's agenda until they win a majority. A socialist worker editorial in the Tuxedo protest summed it up well. The feebleness of the Democrats' protest against the tax cut robbery can be traced to the same source. Since many party figures who make it to Congress are dependent on contributions and political support from corporate America, this is the underlying cause of the Democrats' spinelessness, not tactical ineptitude or cowardice, but the Democratic Party's essential commitment to corporate America and upholding the status quo. And the fact of the matter is, corporate America is doing quite fine with the status quo. They may have some qualms about the more incendiary elements of Trump's agenda, but for now, the economy is booming, profits are up, and from where they sit, life is pretty good. While the protests absolutely have had an impact, forcing Trump and the right to retreat at times, they haven't generated enough of a crisis for the capitalist class to force major concessions. In a year and a half, Trump has delivered shockwave after shockwave. And in response, the Democrats have played what Lance Selfa describes in his book, Democrats' Critical History, which you can pick up in the Haymarket Room. They played the role that he describes as shock absorbers, prioritizing the stability of the state over unending opposition to Trump. This approach has simultaneously legitimized his rule and pulled people out of the streets, thus undermining the social forces with the most potential power to stop Trump's agenda. Pushing the struggle to Mueller in the midterms sends an implicit political message. Sit tight and let the experts handle this. They're the ones with the power to take down Trump. Ordinary people should focus on electing representatives who will be able to carry out the fight on their behalf within the halls of Congress, where the power is. It also reinforces the myth that change is necessarily slow, that an incremental, not radical approach is best, that while protesting might feel good, it doesn't actually accomplish anything real. Finally, it reinforces the idea that the protest movements need a sympathetic party in power in order to win, and obscures the fact that the Democratic Party isn't actually that sympathetic to the demands of the protest movements. However, the experiences people have in mass protests often run counter to those ideas. If you were among the millions who turned out for a women's march, if you were one of the 40,000 who pushed up the far right out of Boston, or a student who organized a walkout in your high school, or a woman who said Me Too, or one of the thousands of teachers who walked out in the biggest strike wave the US has seen in recent memory, you have been a part of something that demonstrates that a fight from below, led by ordinary people, can make a change. That you don't necessarily have to have sympathetic representatives in power in order to win, and you certainly don't need to wait until November to do so. Some people do come to these conclusions on their own, but it's not something we can take for granted. As revolutionary socialists relating to these movements, We want to meet people where they're at and play a role of helping them draw radical conclusions from their experiences. Remember the scale of the protest, 1 in 5 Americans. That is a tremendous amount of people to relate to. As Gianga Yamada Taylor put it just after the first women's marches, liberals become radicals through their own frustrating experiences with the system, but also through becoming engaged with people who became radical before them. At the same time, we don't want to make the mistake of adapting to the political level of the protests. We can empathize with people who are rightfully horrified and looking to the Democratic Party as a solution, but we should maintain a critical and independent stance of the Democratic Party. This is not going to be a popular position with a person like Trump in power, but it's a position worth sticking to. In his speech at the Anti-Inauguration Forum, Anand Gopal said, "A single protest, as important as they are, has never changed anything. But the social movement of linked protests, that is the lifeblood of resistance. That is the only thing, ultimately, that has ever changed anything. And by that, I mean civil disobedience, boycotts, sit-ins, prison solidarity networks, abortion funds, sanctuary spaces, all of it. Resistance isn't a moment, resistance isn't a state of mind, but a tapestry which is collective and enduring. It's so enduring the status quo cannot sleep at night." Linking protests is what socialist organization does. Joel Geyer, writing on socialists and movements in International Socialist Review, argues, "We maintain a link between the struggles of the past and the future ones. We draw the lessons, we train people so that when the next struggle begins, it doesn't begin on the same primitive level as the preceding one. This link, this thread that knits together the movements of today and ties them to a longer history of struggle, is frayed when movements are directed into the second most enthusiastic party of capital. This is the situation we've inherited today, one in which the project of building left organization independent from the Democratic Party has been delayed and defeated for decades. Understanding this history helps to explain why today's resistance finds itself in such a contradictory situation, with massive protests but very little organization, very little impact on Trump's assaults. There's very little space for the people showing up to these protests to come together and make sense of an incredibly disorienting period. The threads that we are picking up that have been left to us through history may be frayed, but it is up to us and the people we are standing arm in arm with the protests to reweave a tapestry of resistance, to build our own organizations that will expand, not contain, the potential power of the protests so they can stand a fighting chance not only against Trump, but against the system that spawned him, capitalism."
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.